The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Dr. Scott Youngkin for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Health Issues. For the next half hour, I'll be reading articles from the Harvard Heart Letter, as well as the Harvard Health Letter. And this is the April 2022 issue of the Harvard Heart Letter. The first article is called Staving Off Heart Problems in Your 80s and Beyond. Prevention and treatment strategies are similar to those for younger people, with a few added nuances and advice. Older Americans are the fastest growing segment of the population, including the oldest old, or people age 85 and older. With advancing age comes an increasing likelihood of health problems, including those affecting the heart. But does preventing and treating heart disease in octogenarians differ from what's recommended for younger people? For the most part, the advice is very similar, says Dr. Patrick O'Gara, a cardiologist at Harvard-affiliated Brigham and Women's Hospital. There is a clear benefit to treating high blood pressure, elevated LDL cholesterol, and diabetes in people in their 80s and older to lower their risk of heart problems, he says. As with younger people, medications are often required to meet recommended blood pressure and other targets. But lifestyle habits that lower heart-related risk should still be the central focus. The first piece of advice that's very important is to stay active. Stick to a program of regular physical exercise. That's probably the most important habit because it improves a range of risk factors, says Dr. O'Gara. Physical activity can improve your mood and the quality and duration of your sleep, which benefits heart health. Walking or other activity that raises your heart rate helps to keep blood pressure in check. Exercise that strengthens your core, like wall push-ups, can improve your balance and prevent falls. Among people 65 and older with coronary artery disease, the incidence of falls is 34%. Compared with 12% in older adults without heart problems, according to one study. Like falls, frailty, a syndrome marked by weakness, fatigue, and wasting, becomes more common with age. If you're frail or have been inactive for a while, gentle exercise for older, frail people is recommended. And this is outlined in the September 2021 issue of Heart Letter. Another thing to think about in older adults is polypharmacy, which means taking five or more medications. Around age 70, it's a good idea to review your medications to see if any adjustments are warranted. Many otherwise healthy people started taking a daily low-dose aspirin in middle age to ward off a heart attack. But once you reach age 70, the risk of bleeding may outweigh any protection against heart attack or stroke if no evidence of atherosclerosis exists. Bleeding can range from minor, like bleeding gums or increased bruising, to more serious complications like bleeding from the stomach, the small intestine, or even the brain. Bleeding risk is also a concern for people taking anti-clotting medications, which are prescribed to treat atrial fibrillation, a heart rhythm disorder that raises the odds of stroke. Once you reach 80, it might make sense to lower the dose of your anti-clotting drug in order to minimize bleeding risk. Weight loss and worsening kidney function, which sometimes occur with age, affects the dosing of some of these medications. although current guidelines suggest aiming for a blood pressure of 130 over 80 or lower, that target might be too aggressive for some people in their 80s. The older you are, the less forgiving your body becomes. You can be susceptible to side effects like dizziness and lightheadedness from blood pressure drugs, says Dr. O'Gara. If that starts happening to you, work with your doctor to dial back your dosage. Another consideration for octogenarians involves when to undergo an invasive heart-related procedure, like an aortic valve replacement. In the past, the general practice was to wait until a person's symptoms became so debilitating that quality of life suffered. But sometimes waiting too long meant the person became so old and frail that valve replacement surgery was too risky. Now a less invasive alternative called transcatheter aortic valve replacement, or TAVR, has become more widely available, expanding eligibility for older people. But there's also a growing trend to do TAVR sooner rather than later, at what Dr. O'Gara calls the golden moment. That's the age at which a person will likely recover easily and still have a good decade of life ahead. Dr. O'Gara has a few patients who are over 100. One recently passed away at the age of 108. Aside from good medical care, is there anything special about these centenarians that contributes to their longevity? They exercise, they do volunteer work, and have access to other types of social activities and interactions that give them a sense of purpose and belonging to the community, says Dr. O'Gara. Now we're going to read an article from the Harvard Heart Letter of April 2022 that's about cardiopulmonary exercise testing. First of all, there's a brief article that asks the question, what is a cardiopulmonary exercise testing? A standard exercise test monitors your heart rate, your heart rhythm, and your blood pressure while you walk on a treadmill or pedal a stationary bike. A cardiopulmonary exercise test is more involved. It collects additional information about your heart and your lung function. During CPET, which means cardiopulmonary exercise testing, you wear a small sensor called a pulse oximeter on your finger that measures your blood oxygen level. You're also fitted with a mouthpiece or mask attached to a device that monitors your breathing to see how efficiently you take in oxygen and exhale carbon dioxide. In an advanced version of the test, doctors use thin, flexible tubes to insert two temporary pressure monitoring devices, one into a neck vein to access the pulmonary artery. Remember, the pulmonary artery brings blood from the heart to the lungs, and another in the radial artery in the arm. Together, these devices show how well blood and oxygen is delivered to and used by your muscles as you exercise. The exercise portion includes a short warm-up, followed by just 5 to 8 minutes pedaling on an exercise bike with gradual increases in intensity. Although the test is invasive, topical painkillers keep the discomfort from the catheters to a minimum. More than 90% of people who undergo invasive CPET testing say the test is not as bad as having a cavity drilled and repaired by a dentist, says pulmonologist Dr. David Systrom, assistant professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School. So now the article goes on and talks more about cardiopulmonary exercise testing. One of the vexing things about certain common health complaints is that the range of possible underlying causes is large. For example, Feeling short of breath is perfectly normal after a burst of vigorous exercise. But for some people, even mild exertion can trigger a sense of breathlessness, what doctors call dyspnea. It's often accompanied by symptoms like fatigue and lightheadedness. Heart or lung issues are usually to blame. In many cases, routine tests like chest x-rays, echocardiograms, lung function tests, and blood tests can uncover the underlying reason for a person's breathlessness. But sometimes all the results are perfectly normal, or the findings don't fully explain the nature or severity of the person's symptoms, says Dr. David Systrom, who directs the dyspnea clinic at Harvard-affiliated Brigham and Women's Hospital. That's where cardiopulmonary exercise testing can play a role. At one time, about half the people referred to the dyspnea clinic who underwent cardiopulmonary exercise testing were found to have pulmonary hypertension. This is an uncommon condition in which the arteries to the lungs become thick and stiff, or heart failure with preserved ejection fraction, a form of heart failure resulting from stiffness in the heart's lower left chamber. But about 5 years ago, we also started seeing more patients with chronic fatigue syndrome. The other name for chronic fatigue syndrome is myalgic encephalomyelitis. This is a complex disease that involves abnormalities in many organ systems, most notably the nervous and vascular symptoms. Many people with MECFS, which remember is myalgic encephalomyelitis chronic fatigue syndrome, have unusual circulatory problems that happen because the peripheral nervous system fails to signal the large veins in the leg, pelvis, and abdomen to constrict and deliver blood back to the heart. This leads to preload insufficiency, which means the heart's upper right chamber doesn't fill and reach a normal pressure before each beat. This problem is not only ubiquitous in people with MECFS, but also extremely common in people with a condition known as long COVID. Of course, COVID is capital COVID. Most people who get COVID-19 recover in weeks or months, but some experience lingering fatigue, lightheadedness, palpitations, brain fog, and breathlessness, described as long COVID. The other name for long COVID is PASC, which stands for post-acute sequelae SARS-CoV-2 infection. Remember, SARS-CoV-2 is the virus that causes COVID-19. PASC, again, remember that's post-acute sequelae of SARS-CoV-2, is most common in young women and typically affects those with only mild infections. Infectious disease expert and White House medical advisor Dr. Anthony Fauci has speculated that PASC is the same or very similar to ME/CSF, which can be triggered by infections, including mononucleosis and Lyme disease. Dr. Systrom and colleagues are using CPET, remember that's cardiopulmonary exercise testing, to better understand PASC in hopes of paving the way for effective treatments. Now here's a short article entitled Research We're Watching, again from the Harvard Heart Letter of April 2022. Olive oil is linked to lower heart-related death. Consuming just a half tablespoon or more of olive oil a day is linked to a lower risk of dying from heart disease and other chronic health conditions. The study included 92,000 women and men from the Nurses Health Study and the Health Professionals Follow-Up Study, who filled out diet questionnaires every 4 years for 28 years. Olive oil intake was calculated from how much they reported using in salad dressings, on bread, and in baking or frying. Compared with participants who never consumed olive oil, those who consumed the most, which was about a half a tablespoon or more daily, had a 19% lower risk of dying from heart disease. Researchers also noted lower death rates overall among people who substituted olive oil for a similar amount of margarine, butter, mayonnaise, or dairy fat. Findings published in the January 18, 2022 issue of the Journal of the American College of Cardiology lend further support for choosing olive oil as a key component of the heart-friendly Mediterranean diet. Finally, another research we're watching brief story is entitled Magnesium and Blood Pressure, What's the Evidence? In January 2022, the FDA announced that companies can make certain health claims regarding the consumption of magnesium and a reduced risk of high blood pressure. Food companies and dietary supplement makers who want to include such claims on their packaging must add some caveats. Specifically, the wording has to make it clear that the evidence to support the claim is inconclusive, according to the agency. If you have high blood pressure, you're better off getting your magnesium from foods that are naturally rich in this important mineral rather than taking pills or eating foods with added magnesium. Where can you get magnesium? Well, from unsalted almonds, peanuts, spinach, and black beans. These foods have the added benefit of containing other nutrients, especially fiber, that may lower blood pressure and are also naturally low in sodium. Too much dietary sodium can raise your blood pressure, and dietary sodium can have a far greater effect on blood pressure than potentially inadequate levels of magnesium. Now we're going to turn to the Harvard Health Letter of April 2022. And I'm going to start by turning to a section called Ask the Doctor by Dr. Anthony L. Komaroff, Editor-in-Chief of the Harvard Health Letter. The question that's asked of Dr. Komaroff is, does a low-salt diet really improve your health? My doctor has been on my case to cut down the salt in my diet. But I like salt, and I hear that not all medical studies show that a low-salt diet really improves your health. Dr. Komaroff's answer is, you're right. The value of a low-salt diet for the average person has been controversial. Many studies have shown that a low-salt diet improves cardiovascular health. However, the studies have had limitations. Some involved relatively few people, and some measured how much salt people say they eat, but not how much salt they actually eat. A study from Harvard published online November 13, 2021, by the New England Journal of Medicine overcame both of these problems. The study involved nearly 11,000 people who were followed carefully for almost 9 years. Researchers measured the amounts of two types of salt that people ate, common table salt, and another mineral often used as a salt substitute called potassium chloride. People who consumed the most sodium chloride had a 60% higher risk of major cardiovascular events, like a heart attack, a stroke, cardiac stent placement, or bypass surgery, compared with those who consume the least. People who consume the most potassium chloride had a 31% lower risk of a major cardiovascular event compared to people who consume the least amount of potassium chloride. In short, this study seemed to say that it would be healthy to substitute potassium chloride for common table salt. This is an observational study and not a randomized trial, so that conclusion really can't be made for sure. Fortunately, a randomized trial published online by the same journal came to a clear conclusion. 21,000 people in China were randomly assigned to use a salt substitute that mixed potassium chloride and sodium chloride, or to use regular table salt. The study participants all were 60 or older and had experienced a stroke in the past, as well as having high blood pressure. In the group that used the salt substitute, the risk of another stroke, a major cardiovascular event, and death were 12% to 14% lower compared with the group that used regular table salt. We don't know if the same would have been true in younger people, people who are not Chinese, or people who had no history of stroke or other cardiovascular disease. Controversial medical issues are rarely completely settled by new studies, because all studies have limitations. These two studies provide strong evidence that a diet with a high content of sodium chloride should be avoided. We should probably be using salt substitutes containing potassium chloride more often, and Dr. Komarov says that he plans to start using potassium chloride as a salt substitute. The next article in the Harvard Health Letter is called Five Common Foot Problems and How to Cope with Them. Every day, more than 50 million people in the United States experience some kind of chronic pain, often in their feet. That's according to a Harvard study published in the February 2022 issue of Pain, which also notes how chronic pain limits the ability to work, to socialize, or to function in general. Fortunately, some new approaches, along with tried and true therapies, can reduce foot pain and keep you active. The first common foot problem this article talks about is bunions. Bunions are a deformity at the base of your big toe, a bump formed where two foot bones aren't connecting properly. If it doesn't bother you, you don't have to do anything about bunions. If it causes chronic pain, you should definitely wear shoes with a roomy toe box or a toe sleeve with a cushion so the bunion doesn't rub against your shoe. A toe spacer, which is a rubber device that sits between the big toe and the second toe, can make the toe lie straighter. Surgery to realign the joint is also an option. We're doing keyhole surgery with thinner tools and incisions that are smaller than ever, just 5 millimeters long. That helps to speed recovery, says Dr. Jeremy Smith, a foot and ankle surgeon at Harvard-affiliated Brigham and Women's Hospital and part of Mass General Brigham's Sports Medicine Division. A second common foot problem is fallen arches. The arch of your foot can flatten if the main tendon in the foot loses elasticity. That can cause chronic pain in the arch, in the ankle, and the leg when you walk. Treatments involving supporting the arch with orthotic insoles and a relatively new approach involves stretching the calf muscles. These muscles can get tight and make the heel bone sit off center. When the heel bone is off to the side, the foot doesn't sit well in the orthotic. He recommends stretching the calf muscles a few times per day and wearing a store-bought or prescription orthotic. Look for over-the-counter insoles that have support base and comfortable and a cushion overlay. They're more comfortable than hard plastic orthotics. A third problem is hammer toes. They look a little like a claw, a bend in the toe joint which makes the tip of the toe angle sharply down. The bent joint juts upward and hurts when it rubs against the top of your shoe. Most people can manage this condition without surgery just by wearing shoes with a roomier toe box or silicone toe sleeves that prevent the toe from rubbing against the shoe. When those strategies don't help, the doctor can stretch the toe with surgery. We release the soft tissues holding up the toe. Sometimes we need to remove a section of bone, depending on the deformity. Again, today's smaller surgical instruments require smaller incisions than in the past. They also point out that ingrown toenails can be a problem. An ingrown toenail occurs when a border of the toenail grows into the skin, causing redness, swelling, and pain. It usually occurs in people who can't trim their toenails well anymore because they can't reach them or see them. The best thing to do is to have a pedicure regularly, even if you're a man. If the ingrown nail isn't infected, soaking it regularly can relieve the pain, as can wearing shoes with roomy toe boxes or sandals. If you can trim the nail yourself, find a podiatrist to do it. If the toe is red, it may be infected. Treatment may require antibiotic cream, and it may require the removal of the nail. Well, it looks like we've run out of time for today's episode of Health Issues. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you enjoyed it. I'm Dr. Scott Youngkin, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Health Issues is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. That's ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thanks for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.